Now on the Apt Up to 11 podcast, Paralympic athlete, Ironman, and paratriathlon American champion, Mohamed Lana. Born in Casablanca, Morocco, Mohamed was born with a birth defect called proximal femoral focal deficiency that effectively left him without a right femur and fibula. Mohamed embodies the saying, it's never too late. He was fit with his first real prosthesis at the age of 20, rode a bike for the first time at 25, crossed the Atlas Mountains at 26, and ran his first marathon at 27. Mohamed has officially qualified for the Paralympics in Paris 2024, making him the first male paratriathlete to make Team USA. We are thrilled to present Mr. Mohamed Lana. Mohamed, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you. Very good. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you here, my friend. Where are you in this vast world right now?
Yeah, I'm in Hayward, California, East Bay.
So you're in California. This is home, right?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Someone who has been in California for how long now?
Well, I've been on and off 12 years in California, where I also spent 2 years in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Your story is fascinating to me. Your limb difference is something that I had never heard of. I was not very familiar. So many people that view the podcast, listen and consume this content, you know, they're used to hearing stories about people that have had amputations. And your limb difference is quite extraordinary. And I want to make sure that I'm not messing this up. You have a birth defect that is called proximal femoral focal deficiency. Did I get that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And if I could explain it through my lens, which is very primitive, I'm sure you can explain it in more of a medical way. When I look at photos of people like yourself, it's almost as if one of your legs is shorter than the other, meaning you have, is it a right foot?
Yeah.
You still have your right foot. It's just you don't have, explain it to me, your femur?
I don't have the femur, the tibia, and also I don't have the, I don't have the femur. You know, the tibia bone, there is two bones. I have only one of them.
Yes.
And then I don't have the hip joint and the hip socket. I don't have that. So there is this kind of unique formation in the top where it's not a knee by the hip and it's not connected to the hip socket. And PFFD, it's a congenital condition that has different variation and different categories.
Yeah.
So there is not like it's not an exact like condition. It just like there is a variation where it's in that range where people sometimes they have 3/4 of their leg, sometimes just like me, like half, missing the whole femur and no knee. Some people they have a knee, but like in the center.
Interesting.
So there is a different variation of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because obviously, I mean, we're organic creatures and we develop in the womb, and when things don't quite, you know, develop in the way in which they're fully formed, you can end up with lots of different variations of a particular type of congenital issue. And I'm just being transparent, I knew nothing about. So looking at images of you when I was prepping for this particular episode, the first thing I notice is your prosthesis, which in my mind, I'm like, wait a minute. It looks like he has a foot, right? And then I realize after doing some diligence on your condition, okay, now I get it. You're actually loading that residual limb or the portion of the limb that is formed with your foot, that is loading into a prosthetic, and then you have an additional prosthesis, whether that's a blade or whatever you're employing, that gives you the ability to touch surfaces, and obviously in your case, perform like a world-class athlete, which is, it blows me away, literally, to see some of the things that you're doing. And I think what's most extraordinary about all of that is you have not been necessarily in a prosthetic your whole life. Because what was the age that you first donned a prosthesis?
Yeah, so I just want to go back just a little bit to the running setup and the walking setup. Because I don't have the hip joint, the hip socket, most 90% of the weight that I have on my walking leg or running leg is on the ischium that I have. So my leg is going all the way high up to the ischium where this is where we put the weight, especially running.
Got it.
And the foot, I love my little foot and my kids play with it all the time. It helps me get a little bit of that, what you say, the weight bearing, but most of it is up there by the ischium.
Got it.
Growing up, I was born in Casablanca and we were a very modest family. And back then, we didn't go to the hospital to give birth. It's just at home. You have the local midwife who, when she heard it's time of the woman, she will come and help her deliver her baby.
And did you have siblings?
So I was the first one. I was the
first of how many?
Of five.
Okay, so first of five.
Yeah.
First baby's coming. There's a big deal in the family.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? And you come from, a very simple kind of life, Casablanca, Morocco. You're not necessarily employing, state of technology hospitals, this and that. You're like, hey, midwife's coming and we're going to have our first baby. And Muhammad arrives.
Well, it was not that easy because... I was troubled since day one. The first one is because we don't know, with my kids too, like you check the baby, you need to have the head first and all that stuff. I came with my legs first. Mm. And then that was all make it complicated. And my left arm got stuck. And this is my wife, my mom telling me the story that it was like chaotic and the lady had to put her hand inside to break my shoulder to bring me out.
Wow.
To save my life. So I was born with a broken shoulder and it affected my arm, like length and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But that was and everybody's watching. Like we lived in a family where it's not just my parents and it's like my grandparents, my other uncle and his family. It's like a big house with everybody in the same, everybody's waiting, everybody's watching. So in the beginning, it was a very sad moment. For my parents, because you are waiting for that pride and your first son and all that stuff, and it was not what I expected. But we believe in God and the faith, like pushed them down to just move on and take care of me. They took me to the local doctors to see if there is a cure to this, or I don't know, surgery, whatever. And the doctor, the orthopedic, just said, like, just take him home and take care of him.
Yeah, take him home and love him the way he is. And
yeah,
and all that love and care, look where it took you.
Yes.
Pretty cool story, right?
yeah. But also, like, waiting for the second baby was a lot of, with my parents having my sister, there was a lot of... like intense moment. Is this going to be the same as me or not? And like, it was same born at home and like, yeah, it was such a relief for them. But anyway, all my other, I'm the only one with the birth defect like this. And, my other four siblings are fine. But my parents, I think this is where a huge difference is. Like they treated me like my other siblings, like, meaning, like no special or exceptional treatments. You get punished when you do a bad thing. You get reward when you do a bad thing. So it was like, this is like how I grew up.
Do you think so that created some resilience for you as far as dealing with your limitation and knowing, like, no one's going to help you along here, Muhammad. Like, you have to do what you have to do to get ahead in life.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about this subject. Back then, when you have, I think things have changed now, but back then when you have a physical disability, where you're born with it or something like that, it means like life is over for you. And parents, society treat you like you have a mental something. Like, you just like, we're going to take care of you. You don't have to work hard. You don't have to go to school. We're going to take care of you. And that's, I think things have changed now, but back then that was the mentality. But I went to elementary school where all of us were just kids with physical disability, just physical. And the whole elementary school, like 6 years of education, basically we're going to a daycare. Yeah. We just spend the day there playing, having fun. We didn't learn anything and just coming back home.
Yeah.
Basically. And that caused a lot of problem afterward, because when I switched to middle school, it was very hard for me. That's the reality of education and all that stuff. And I suffered. That was the period where I suffered a lot. But
and suffered because you had not given a foundation educationally, or suffered in that kids, you were no longer in a space where you shared sort of a common bond with other kids with disabilities, like you were with like normal, or let's call them, I don't know, able-bodied or whatever. I hate to use a lot of those words, because I don't know if they're necessarily representative of situations. I try to be careful with that talk, but difficult in both regards, or one or the other?
It's more like the educational, the foundation part.
Okay.
Because back then, I had really like a very balanced life. I would spend the school day with the kids with this physical disability. And it was good because I saw a lot of physical, different disabilities.
Yeah.
Back then it was a lot of polio, because we had a lot of polio in Africa. Mm-hmm. But coming back home, I would also go, like, we didn't have any after school program or anything. You just go home, eat, and go outside the street and play.
Yeah.
And basically open the door and start playing with other kids, fighting with other kids.
Yep.
And in Morocco, soccer is the game. Like, this is what we play day and night.
Sure.
So I would just be
playing. Yeah, it's like baseball in the US. You had soccer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and, I get it. And yeah, what I was going to ask you is, it sounded to me from my research on you that you were like a really active kid, that you were not, you weren't like, you know, like suffering away in like a dark closet. Like, you were like, no, I want to be out there. And I have this energy. And obviously anyone that follows you taps into what your journey has been, especially your Paralympic journey, can see that you're this very, very bright light, that you are someone that is sort of resonating, you know, this energy, that you seem very alive, let's put it that way. And I find that to be a huge source of curiosity for me, because I always want to trace it back to, well, you know, what were you like as a child? And I think I read somewhere that, you know, you were just kind of like always getting into everything. No one could kind of like hold you back, so to speak. And when you say soccer, explain to me, given your socioeconomic situation, given where you were growing up, what was resources that were available to you, how did you maintain such an active life as a kid?
Yeah, this is a good question. Thank you. So first of all, when I start crawling, like, you can crawl like with my disability, like any other kids, but once you start walking, it's kind of this funky, unbalanced walking.
Yeah.
And when I was younger, the difference was not that high. So my dad hates watching me like that. So he would take me to the local, it was like the guy who repairs shoes, cobbler, what do we call him? the person who repairs shoes.
You know, anyway, the shoe guy.
So he, shoe guy, yeah. So he will take me to the shoe guy and he will just like put layers of foam under my shoe. This way he balanced the height.
So what was the differential as a kid? Like how many inches was the differential when you were a child?
So it was growing. The difference was was getting bigger and bigger as I'm growing. Getting taller. So I remember it was like this much. I don't know, like 5-6 inch. And then as I'm getting taller, it gets bigger. And I remember like every time, like someone 6 months or whatever, my dad will take me to this guy. He will buy a nice solid leather shoes and maybe 2 sizes up.
Yeah.
And the guy will just slap layers of foam all what I have, pink, yellow, blue, whatever. Yeah, I had like this rainbow shoe. And it got to a point where it just starts breaking because I was running like crazy, playing soccer with other kids in the street.
Yeah.
And then it got to a point where it was not sustainable. My dad got me crutches, like wooden crutches from I don't know where. And I break everything. Yeah. Everything growing up.
Because you're a super physical kid, you're just breaking stuff. And you're out, yeah. You're not only outgrowing what you said, it's not sustainable. Like, you know, how big of a heel can we create? And I'm able to run, right? Because here's this very rambunctious, active, pushing the barriers kind of kid that seems to only be happiest and smiling when their body is moving.
Exactly.
This kid does not want to sit like just in a chair and observe the world. He wants to engage. He wants to do these things. And, you know, it's remarkable to me that all of that winding path of your upbringing and, you know, having an opportunity, which I want to discuss a little bit more. What was sort of the moment that led you into competitive sports and coming, you know, the U.S. being a possibility? Because I think based on the research I was doing, you actually represented Morocco initially, correct? As a Paralympian?
Yes.
And that somehow transcended to you representing the U.S. as well. When did becoming a Paralympian or the possibility of competing on a world stage, when did that sort of get plugged into your brain? Like who, was it a person? Was it just you saw something on television? When was that moment where you had that little light bulb go off where you went, wait a minute, like I could do something with my physical body that other people can't or aren't willing to sacrifice themselves to? When did that happen for you?
Yeah, it happened like very early, like around, I would say 10, 11. Mm. My dad is a taxi driver.
Okay.
And one day he has this client, he was limping, he has crutch, like one crutch and he was limping, but he was, anyway, he got him and he was start talking to him, taking him to his destination. And talking, I have a son, blah, 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 with this. And the guy start talking to him. And the guy said, I want to see your son. And right now, I say, yeah, right now. So they drove home. And I was home back then at the time. I think it was a weekend or something like that. And this guy, my dad came home, say, I want to introduce you to this guy. And I was shy when there is a stranger. I was hiding behind my mom. And this guy, like very tall guy. I remember how the entrance to the house, this hallway, wearing this long coat and tried to shake my hand. He has this massive hands. and all this, I have them like memories ingrained in my brain. And he was very friendly, wanted to talk to me. And he was talking to me, but I was not like really listening. The only thing that I picked up as I will take you with me to the swimming pool. And I've never been to a swimming pool before in my life.
Oh, wow.
And never, I've never seen a swimming pool or swimming. I don't know how to swim or anything. Later on, this guy, he's the only Moroccan Paralympic swimmer who went to the Paralympics in swimming and won a bronze medal. And until today, he's the only Paralympic or Olympic swimmer who had Olympic or Paralympic medal. He's the only person so far until today. Anyway, that guy one day came home, took me with him to the pool. He was very well respected. I remember he took me with the pool all the way with his car all the way inside the pool, the gate. Like he's like, he owned the place. He's like his own pool, but this is like a public pool that allowed him to go with his car inside.
Sure.
And he took me to the pool and he said, okay, well, just sit on the board of the pool for now. I will do my workout and come back and I will play with you a little bit, basically. And for me, the smell of the chlorine of that 50 meter underground pool and the people swimming and the noise and the echoes, it's just like everything. This is all new to me.
Yeah.
And I just, wow, this is very dreamy. I love this. And the lifeguard walked by and I see him and I try to not look at him. And he came to me and say, what do you do in here? What do you do here? Do you know how to swim? And I say, yes. And he said, okay, show me. And without hesitation, I jump in the water and I drown, obviously. And I don't know how to swim.
Well, yeah, there you go. I'm just imagining young Mo. I can swim. Help.
And I drowned and they had somebody to pull me off the water, out of the water. And that was my experience with the whole thing, with swimming, with the Paralympic athletes.
That was your baptism right there.
Exactly.
Right into the water.
Right in the water, baptism into sport.
That's wonderful.
So, yeah.
Go ahead.
And I wanted to learn how to swim. And his name is Jalil. He went to the Paralympics. He's traveling the world. He's well respected. He's like solid. I want to be like him. Unfortunately, it didn't happen because so many reasons. The financial aspect, it was very hard to get into the pool frequently. It was very hard to get to swim with the team. 2 years later, we found this team that for physical, with athletes with disability, that they do once a week for a swim and started with them, but it wasn't enough to reach the Paralympic level at all. Like, we have all this event in Morocco, like for swimming championship and all this stuff, but it was a very low level. So I did that for, I don't know, 5, 6 years, 7 years.
Yeah.
And then it came to this reality where, okay, I'm never going to do this. I start working as a graphic designer, and then my dad also, again, is a taxi driver, heard about this. Because all these years, I had this, I got to a point where I got this leg, walking leg that is made of wood. The foot is wood.
Yeah.
2 bars of aluminium and leather around my foot.
So like a primitive prosthesis that you could walk around in now.
Yeah, no knee, nothing. But I was very happy with it. And I had that for since I was like 14 all the way to 24 year old.
Yeah.
So at that time, my dad discovered this center that serves Moroccan veteran who served in World War II. It's a French service in Morocco, in Casablanca. So we went there. We saw the doctor there. We saw the service. They did an examination and all that stuff. But they said, we don't serve you, but we're going to keep your file just in case. And 6 months later, they had this, what do we call this? Like, they have this prosthetist came from France to do this training for local prosthetists. And the team was birth defect. So I came, they called me, say, yes, you may have a leg, blah, blah, blah. I was super excited. I got my first leg with like articulation. It was this hinge on the side.
Ooh, awesome.
But the twist in this is the guy was planning this bike event between French MPT and Moroccan MPT, and he asked me if I wanted to join. And I never biked before. I don't have a bike. I say yes.
You said, yeah, of course. I bike all the time.
All the time.
Just like I can swim. I bike.
Exactly. And all along this way, these pieces keep coming together. So we did the event. I loved cycling. I fell in love with cycling. And I started doing, basically after that, it was like 500 kilometers in the Atlas Mountain. I fell in love with mountain biking. I was just doing mountain biking every weekend with my friends, go camping, do mountain bike. Camping,
do you feel, because what you're describing to me, I've heard from different athletes like yourself, did you ever feel in that process, like, I'm kind of a natural at this, like, I'm good at this. Like, and I'm not trying to diminish your training. I'm not trying to diminish your focus, you know, your nutrition, you know, all the key elements that go into competing on this level, right? Because so few of us get the privilege of, you know, not only, you know, representing a country, but also being considered an elite athlete, you know, where your body, I mean, your body's literally a machine, like you take care of it in such a way. But was there ever a moment, because I'm a musician, been a musician my whole life. I always felt like there were guys that work so hard. They practice, they rehearse, they work so hard, but they never really quite get there, right? And I always felt like I had kind of this gift where it was hard and it required a lot of effort, but there were certain kind of core characteristics that I thought, I didn't really have to try that hard to do that. Like, it just kind of came to me, like my body just sort of agrees with this, right? Yeah. When I first, you know, I'm thinking about you first getting into a pool, like I can do this. Well, yeah, I got to train, but some of it's in me. Like, there's something about me as a person physically, spiritually, whatever you want to call it, you get on a bike and you say, I love this. Like, I don't just love it because I see it as a, you know, sort of a vehicle to get me to competition. I actually love doing this. Like, it makes me feel something spiritually that I know my body needs and my mind needs to feel alive, to feel human, right? And yeah. it's only, I'm just so much more blessed that people recognize that and they want to propel my talent into a space that I can compete, represent, and also inspire other people and reach my personal best as an athlete, right? Because so much of what I see in you, just following you, is this joy that you have about what you do, because, you know, people can be hard-nosed competitors and, you know, they're all full of, you know, just sort of like, you know, stern and grit, and they're just, you know, I'm this machine that just destroys everything around me. You definitely seem very formidable, don't get me wrong, but you have this joy about you. And, you know, I look at your list of accomplishments. It's kind of intimidating. You know, it's like para triathlon world championship in 2011, Ironman world championship in 2014, Rio Paralympics in 2016, Norseman extreme triathlon 2017, world para triathlon series in 2018, 2020 Tokyo Paralympic Games. I mean, Mo, it's a lot to digest, right? Like, how does this guy do it all and stay that focused and that committed to reaching those plateaus? I mean, where do you see that balance for yourself? So when someone says, shit, man, how do you do it all? You know, what's your typical response?
I don't know, man. To be honest with you, like, I mean, part of it maybe my upbringing. Our life was very, very modest and very simple. We didn't have a lot of things, and also, like, for example, in middle school and high school, I wasn't able to do like PE because I have disabilities, so I wasn't able to play with my classmates doing basketball or handball or for for like 6 years. When you go to school, I was not able to do that because I'm missing part of my leg. And I think my parent, the way they educated me, I think big part of that back to them is being grateful of what you have and appreciate what you have. And also when things come to you, don't be quick at refusing. I think that's like whatever opportunity, like conversation with a stranger, whatever, like just take it and give it time, respect it. And I think with that in my mind, I think where I am today is because of a lot of people that I met that helped me along the way. I learned from them. My best friend, Patrice, who is a prosthetist, he's a French prosthetist who lives in France. I spent so much time with him. I learned a lot from him. Like, I will tell you this story. Like, it changed my mind forever. When we went to do triathlon, I know how to swim. I know how to cycle. I want to do triathlon. So I was working full time, and he's a prosthetist. He's working full time. But back then, because I didn't have the hip socket, the idea that I have with the doctor in Morocco say, you can't run because you don't have that balance. You can't run. And this is when I was like 26, 27 year old. So the next thing that came to my mind is, and with Patrice, like, let's use a racing wheelchair. Those, you know, racing wheelchair. Let's do one of these. And we couldn't find one. It's too expensive. We didn't have the money for it. Mm. And we couldn't find a used one. He was looking in France for his friend. He couldn't find a used one. So, and one day he came to me and say, and it's been like 2 years we are looking for a racing wheelchair and to start doing triathlon. And he said, why we don't make it ourselves? And I looked at him and say, you are full of shit. Look at this. I mean, I didn't say it right, but in my mind, have you seen
a I'm going to run over to the hardware store and get the parts real quick. I'll be right back.
Yeah, Dean, have you seen a racing wheelchair? Look, aerodynamic, two large wheels, front wheel, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
And like, I paused for a moment. And you know when you say, yeah, like with hesitation, but you are not convinced.
Yeah.
And say, because out of respect, because he's trying to help me and mm-hmm. I don't want to be a jerk to him. I say, yeah, okay, we can give it a try with low confidence. I said, okay. And the first thing is, okay, do you know a friend who has a racing wheelchair? I said, yes. So can you ask him to borrow it for one night just to take pictures and measurement? Mm-hmm. So I can do that. So I went, I asked a friend, we brought it to his lab, like to his where he worked. And we took a bunch of pictures, measurements, like all that stuff. And this is like nighttime. Every night after work, my work as a graphic designer and his work as a CPO, we have dinner around 7 and we start working on this.
Wow.
And we'll go like find like pieces of scrap of metals and random wheels. And like, we're just like looking for junk pieces in Casablanca, in those weird markets. And he managed to get like a welding, I don't know what you call it in English. We call it the post. But anyway, the welding machine and all this stuff. And I started learning how to weld. And okay, I don't know where this is taking us.
You're a welder
and
now.
After a month, we made it. We built a racing wheelchair.
It's incredible.
It was heavy. It was like basically when you push it, it's like you're doing weightlifting with the racing wheelchair. Like
you push it like a weight sled or something in the gym.
But there is two things to this. The first thing is, and it's not perfect, but we made one step forward. It's heavy as hell, but it's a racing wheelchair. I can train on it. I can go to a flat surface and push.
Yeah.
And I get started. And the second thing is, after 6 months, his boss was watching me every time I go to his work office because we started there. I will go there before work to go train and come back. He saw me like for 2 weeks and he asked Patrice, like, what is this? Blah, blah, blah. And then he went and he pressed one of his friends who has a company to pay for a proper racing wheelchair.
Yeah.
So for me, this sequence, it happened within 8 months and crazy, like from nothing to top and equipment that I needed.
Yeah.
But if I didn't say yes, and I made that first step and trusted him and worked, and nothing would happen, maybe I would be still waiting for this race in wheelchair 10 years later. Yeah. So this lesson, like, for example, people like Patrice, everywhere in the US, in Europe, where I lived for a couple of years, I try to learn from them and appreciate all the stuff that I have and also strive for more. And that this race in wheelchair story has just like changed my mind.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah.
No, I really am a firm believer in the idea that as humans, we make our luck.
Yeah.
I'm not a big believer in, like, you know, luck as a concept. I believe that when we engage opportunities, conversations, when we make ourselves available and present in these situations, things just naturally start to come to you. You become magnetic in a sense, right? Because so much of everything you're describing was what I was reading this article the other day, and they were talking about just highly intelligent people. And I'm not trying to blow smoke here. I'm just saying highly intelligent people are open to new ideas. They're very good listeners. And when they see opportunities for growth, no matter what it is, and it doesn't necessarily have to lead to something as like a reward system.
Yeah.
Just purely in the space of, oh yeah, I want to learn that. I want to know more about that. Or that might be an interesting experience just to have. Those are typically the people that advance most in life. And it's a component of intelligence that you're willing to receive it. Because we all know the opposite end of that spectrum. It's, you know, it's the narcissist that knows it all. And, you know, that's not how you get a wheelchair. This is how you get a wheelchair. And this is what you're supposed to do. And you're supposed to, you know, this is how everyone else is doing it. It's like, no, I'm willing to try. And maybe just through the game of chance, which life is, we will make our luck in this situation. Something along the way will sort of fall into place. And I do a lot of that type of coaching in my professional life, where I try to get people to understand that every day is an opportunity to learn something new, maybe something that you never considered, a perspective, you know, a different way of dealing with a problem, something that you might surprise yourself you never knew before. But you have to be in that receiving position, right? You have to be able to say, let's have a conversation about that. Because shutting down and not allowing yourself that space for growth, you're doing such a huge disservice to yourself. And I do believe that some of your adventurous spirit as a child, you know, the funny story about, I know how to swim, or, you know, I know how to ride a bike. All of those things, I think, lent themselves to just creating more opportunities for you. Just because you were willing to fake it just a little bit, right? The whole, like, cliche, you know, fake it till you make it. Because I in my professional life, I run into so many people. They demand so much train up, right? I need to know step by step what I'm supposed to do to be able to negotiate this situation. And I'm like, stop it. Just do it. That's it. That's all I'm going to tell you today, right? Nike came up with this great slogan at some point. Yeah. Just do it. Stop talking. Yeah. Stop thinking. Just do it. The rest of the stuff can come. As long as you're not putting yourself in danger, reverse engineering a situation, which is kind of what you guys did. You're like, well, we'll just come up with something, right? And it'll allow you to train, and it'll get us in that headspace. All of that led, you know, to you getting the equipment that you needed, which we all know for athletes like yourself, those types of support systems are very important. People need to have those resources available. The best equipment, proper training, you know, the right kind of facilities, things that are critical so that you can reach your personal best. And we can enhance this human experience, you know? So talking about competition, how do you feel, you know, your particular regimen, depending on where you're going to be competing, what you're going to be doing, you know, what does that look like for you? And does that change depending on the circumstances surrounding, you know, if you said, well, if it's a triathlon versus, you know, a Paralympic event or something like that, you know, how do you approach your training? And then what support do you look for in those situations?
Well, I mean, Paralympics are very special, so every 4 years, and you don't want to miss that opportunity. And I mean, my thinking and my how I see things have changed over time. When I was going to Rio, I was like a train. Like, I just see Rio, nothing else. And when we had to train and also like race, I don't remember all these places that I went to, like visiting. Like, I just went for the race, and Rio is what I see.
Focus.
So I didn't enjoy the process that much because I was just focusing on the goal, the end goal, which is Rio. And I get intense, very intense, like when I have a big goal to achieve, and training become like priority number one. Obviously, this past 8 years, things have changed, like work, family. I have 3 kids. You get older, you need to sleep more and all that stuff, recover more and all that stuff. So you have to organize yourself much better, be strategic, be smart about your training. And like going like with my coach, Derek, because I'm part of the USA Triathlon Resident Team Hybrid program. Sorry. Like last 2 years, our goal is to find that balance between family, work, and training. How we can find that balance, we get to that point where we can be competitive and try to get a qualification as early as possible. So we try to have that goal first, consistency, and then qualification as early as possible. And we try to work with that. Like, my coach is really smart, man, Derek Williamson. He knows I have a family, I have work, how we can make all this work together.
Yeah, I think that life, work, competitive balance, man, yeah. For someone like yourself, I would think that's, you know, a big part of sort of working smart. And to have a support system, like a coach that understands that and says, yeah, listen, I know that, you know, dependent on all these other factors, if we are giving you what you need and feeding all of those different priorities of your life, you are going to bring your best self to this competition. If we start robbing you and pulling back away from these vital things that you need in your life, and that could be something as basic as, I need some time with my kids. Just to feel spiritually, mentally well. And I understand what you're saying. When we're younger, sometimes that goal, we get like this sort of tunnel vision where it's just, this is the thing that I'm doing right now. And all of this other stuff is just static. And you become so driven, like, I'm blocking all that out right now. None of that matters. That's what matters right there, right? And like you're saying, and I appreciate your transparency, as we get a little older, as some of normal life starts to build around us, we don't necessarily want to see that as, you know, kind of like a weight that's holding us back. It can be cultivated in such a way that it actually becomes the fuel that propels us forward. If it's respected in a way that it seems that your coach understands, for you to find that balance. When you're preparing, let's say on game day, what's the mental process that you go through? I mean, when you're in the starting blocks, I mean, what are you thinking of?
So for me, for my past games, I like to do a lot of visualization, like for the bike course, swim course, run course. I always like to see the course, imagine myself, like prior, like a month before the race, like when I'm swimming, I always swim in and imagine myself in that pontoon swimming race day.
Yeah.
When I'm cycling, we know the course, we know the turns, we know the laps, and I try to like when I'm doing bike workouts in the trainer or outdoor, I would try to start imagining myself in that. What's the power, what's the cadence and all that stuff. And the same thing with the run. So doing that for, I don't know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before race day makes it easy race day. Like you just go, it's another time. Bismillah, let's go. And
almost like you've been there already.
Exactly. And it worked for me like almost all the big event, the important event. I will do that. And when I go, like I don't scramble or try to think or I'm like, what's going to happen? Like you just go for it. You know, you did it before. You know exactly what's going to happen. And yeah, I think this trick helps me a lot in all the big events. And doing it again, doing the work, like put everything in the training.
Yeah.
And the outcome, here's the thing, like this is how also I evolved, because before, like I need to win or I need to do this or I need to do this. But in triathlon, there is a lot of things that we don't control. You get a flat and that's it, you're out of the race. You do an extra lap on the bike or crash, whatever. Or, you know, things can happen and it can happen to you. There is nothing, like this is life.
Right.
But this is why, like, the training, enjoying the journey with your family, with your friends. And then, you know, because when you do this, like you don't care what people think of you, but this is, you're doing it for yourself first. You know that you put all the work, you did everything need to be done. You followed the steps, you trained very hard, your body is ready, you're primed. And the outcome, you have no control. You do your best and you go for it. Yeah. And this is, it changed the perspective and how you see things. And this is how I'm approaching yeah, the events. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about what you're approaching, you know. Let's talk about Paris.
Yeah.
Tell me about
it. This is a roller coaster. So after Rio, because back then I wasn't citizen, US citizen. I was representing my home country, Morocco. It was great. Finished bronze, loved it. Came back home. The plan with my wife is, let's say, to retire and take care of the kids, the family, enjoy yeah. it. And then like 2 months later, I say, honey, I still have it in me. And I want to go. I want to race for the US. We are here. Our kids are American. I want to race. This way, I have one for my home country and one for the US.
Oh, wow.
I say, okay, all right. But this time, I want to go train in Colorado Springs in the Olympics.
Awesome.
So I'm so lucky. Like if anything in this life, my wife, she's the gift. She's the greatest gift that I ever have. She's like amazing.
What a beautiful sentiment. How old are your kids, Mo?
I have 12, 8 and 8. 12, 8 and 4. Two boys and one girl.
So they're little. I mean, to see dad doing these things has got to be, it's got to be just extraordinary to them, just wonderful. And
yeah.
And I would think as a father, because, you know, I raised 5 kids, that being that sort of Superman in that space, it's a great feeling and part of your legacy. You know, the things I always think about, like, what do I want my kids to remember me for, right? And I certainly want them to remember me in an intimate sense, like, was he funny? Was he silly? You know, did he tell us great stories? Things like that. But what was his constitution like? What did he represent? You know, what did he do? Where did he place his energy in the world? And someone like yourself, who against a lot of odds, rose you know, to find a personal best, not only as a person, but as an athlete, and to be able to celebrate that with you. You know, think back, you know, when you got the bug as a kid and saying, hey, I, you know, I'm pretty active kid and I think I could, you know, channel all this energy that I have and do something with it, to know that someday your own children would be celebrating that with you. And that part of your, you know, Paralympic experience would be sort of woven in, you know, to their lives as well. And it's beautiful that you have the support, you know, of your wife, and sounds like hopefully if your parents are around, that they'd be very, very proud of what you've accomplished in your life. And I would imagine your siblings as well, you know, seeing what you've done to this point. It's such a huge celebration of life, and that so many amazing things can come from how you described when you were born. And it was kind of a, okay, we don't know how this is going to go, right? I mean, that was admittedly what you described as, and I think most new parents would describe as a complex kind of sad day to say, yes, he's here, but we're not really sure where this is all going to go. And all we can do is, you know, you have your faith and you say, you know, maybe he'll have a decent life. And, you know, it's funny, you know, Zach had introduced me, Zach Friedley had introduced me to you on, I think it was on Instagram. And, I mean, I don't want to quote him because I don't remember the exact words. He's like, you know, I need to introduce you to Muhammad. Mo is, he's one of the most incredible people I've ever met in my life.
He's so nice.
And I thought, wow, that's quite an endorsement. I'm like, I think I need to meet this person, you know? And, you know, discovering your path and your history and your amazing athleticism has been a huge inspiration to myself. And, you know, I'm an everyday, you know, average, you know, amputee that, you know, discovered his fitness level much later in life. And remember that people like yourself don't just inspire, you know, people that are trying to compete. You just inspire people to find their best self, whatever that is. And, you know, for me as an amputee, my biggest goal several years ago was just being able to walk again.
Yeah.
Just being able to walk across the room. And that just, as you know, that can just build from there. Because you train, and from what I, you know, all the conversations I have with people like yourself, training's very incremental. You know, you try to figure out, well, what can I do, right? And what can I do well? And then how do I keep building on that? How do I push myself further? And the human body's amazing in that sense, that you can, in little kind of incremental, small little ways, you can keep going further, right? I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, the idea of getting on a bike, I would have said, there's no fucking way I'm getting on a bike. Yeah. Like, it's just not happening. And I recall the first time getting on a bike and my hands were shaking. I mean, literally. Because, you know, as an amputee, I don't know where my foot is. And, you know, you have a special prosthesis that, you know, you don't have the touch either, you know? So, you know, that feeling of, I'm going to fall. And to be able to enjoy, you know, a 40 or 50 mile ride in the summer here in Chicago, it's wonderful for me and something I never thought I could do, but it's very affirming in knowing that anything is possible. If you put yourself in the right place, if you draw energy from the right types of people, it's amazing what you can accomplish. And I'm talking to our entire audience, all the amputees out there, everyone that has a limb difference that's holding them back. Even the smallest of victories are worth celebrating. So if there's something you didn't think you could do that now you're doing, congratulations, because that's a victory. And we all have to support each other in that regard. And I so appreciate you sharing your story today. When are the games? Are they August, correct?
So my race is September 1st.
Okay, I think you're in September. Okay.
End of August, beginning of September. I just want to go back to all the amputee, like trying to walk or be active or do a little bit of, I mean, I'm talking about even like, I do a lot of things with other amputee who are racing high level. And I was just going to give example of running with the running leg. It's not easy. You get blisters all the time. You need to have the right socket. Like the last year I had to go to Chicago like 3 times to work with David there for the right socket.
He's my prosthetist too, by the way.
Yeah. David Rotter helped me a lot to make because I have a foot and I have it was very complicated and it's a pain to make my socket. You will hate, like my prosthetist, he will hate me, but he didn't. But my point is, it's not going to be easy. It's your limb size will change and maybe your leg will not fit or you need to put like different socket players. So this is part of the struggle that you need to know all the people out there, amputee who are racing on high level, they go through every day.
Yeah.
It's not something just like you see the pictures on Instagram or whatever, Facebook, and everything looks good. No. Yeah. We had sometimes to put the leg and use crutches because we have a blister that we can't use. We can't run for a week or so on. So I want people to put that in mind and don't be afraid and keep working on getting the right equipment, right socket for you for walking, running, or cycling, whatever activity you prefer.
Yep.
It will change your life. Doing 3 times or once a week, going for a hike or a walk or a jog, it will change your mind forever and you will be much, much, much happier. But now that all of us suffer from those complications, it's just life. Having blisters, the socket doesn't fit, it's part of the game.
Yeah, I so appreciate you saying that. And I really do from the bottom of my heart, because so often people look at, you know, these very, very high functioning amputees and it's almost counterproductive. And what I mean by that, in the sense that they almost resent someone that is high functioning in that space. And what I try to get people to understand is exactly what you're saying. Do you have any idea? Everyone's struggle is real. Everyone goes through something. Everyone has skin breakdown. Everyone has all these things that occur. And it's painful, and they have to modify their behavior, and they have to have down days. You see one picture, or you see one, you know, competition, and you think you completely shut down, and you say, "Well, I'm not going to do that, and that's never going to happen." And well, it must be nice to have the best equipment. It must be nice to have all this stuff and all these sponsors and this and that. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa! Wait a minute. None of that is achieved. None of it. Without a tremendous amount of struggle. It's tremendous. And you have to believe that it's a process, that nothing is achieved overnight, that it is a daily siege. It is a military exercise. It is, I have to go through these steps to reach my personal best, no matter what it is. If you're the kind of person that says, I just want to be able to walk around my neighborhood. I want to be able to take my dog and walk around the neighborhood. That was something that gave me joy. That was something that I miss most about my past life. Okay, then I say, that's your Olympic Games right there.
Exactly.
Taking your dog around the neighborhood. That is your goal. That is your big dream. You need to figure out how to make that happen. So we need to go all the way back in our steps and start at step one. What's step one? Okay. We need to figure out what that is and start from there and start building in small increments. Okay. And that might start with getting the right socket. It might start with getting the right fit. It might start with maybe you employing some chair aerobics. Start moving your body again. Start getting your blood pumping. Okay. Fall in love with the feeling you get from exercise again. Okay. Because so many people reach a point where they estrange themselves from activity and then they think that there's no going back ever again. And that's just not true. Movement is life, period. It's just how it works.
I love that.
Yeah. These bodies we have were not meant to be still. As long as we're moving, we keep living. I mean, as morbid as it sounds, the moment we stop, that's when everything starts to shut down. Okay. So no matter what your limitation is, no matter what situation you're in, I would tell anyone, just please, please just keep moving. And if that means from a wheelchair, that's okay. Just keep moving. That's all that matters in this situation. So Muhammad, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing your story. We will be watching, not to put any pressure on you. we will be watching Paris in 2024 this year. I can't wait to follow you and see what your outcomes are. No matter what, I'm sure it's going to be glorious and fantastic. Please don't be a stranger. Again, thank you so much. My name's Rick Bonkowski. This is the Amped Up 211 podcast. I want to wish everyone health and happiness. That's it for us today. We'll see you next time.